I'm Marco Werman. We've reached our goal for the spring fundraiser. The world raised $134,000. That's $134,000 to help pay for the reporting that you depend on each day. It helps us meet the cost of bringing you the news, and it's proof that you value the world's journalism. Thank you for helping us make the world available for free to everyone. If you meant to contribute, there's still time. Go to theworld.org/give. And thank you for supporting the world. Americans protesting to end the lockdowns. That is baffling for some people abroad.
I have no idea, you know, why these people would do that. I mean, it is risky.
I'm Marco Werman. It's warming up and the great outdoors is seductive. But is it safe? Canadian public health officials sending mixed messages to an antsy public.
Please go outside. Go outside with your family.
Outdoor means it depends what you're doing and what setting you're in.
Also, scientists are stuck at home just like everyone else. That means their research is also on pause.
I was supposed to be on the ship at the moment, but that, of course, didn't happen.
Long-term science projects will have a pandemic-sized hole in their data. And later, listen along with us to the sounds that emerge when we just slow down. All that and more today on The World. Always blame China. That seems to be the refrain in Washington right now. President Trump has been lobbing insults at China over its handling of the coronavirus outbreak. He's accused the Chinese government of withholding information and responding too slowly to the crisis. China has been fighting back.
You've got officials in both sides who are gearing up for a permanent, lasting rupture in the relationship. And I think you've got populations in both countries that are becoming increasingly supportive of that idea.
That's Jude Blanchett. He's a China scholar at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And he sees the rivalry between the two superpowers growing increasingly ominous.
Senior leadership in Beijing has been calling for decoupling for a very long time and has really believed a narrative that the United States is intent on stifling China's rise and that China needs to take preparatory steps. We're seeing that same message now coming out of this administration, which is Communist Party is a fundamental bad actor. I think there is a teased out narrative of the Chinese people need to think about a different leadership structure. That's a recipe for a more prolonged rivalry and one where there's not much imaginative thinking, I think, in either side.
What you're describing sounds dramatic. It sounds historic. What would it even mean? Can you even wrap your head around the scenarios if there is a very serious rupture?
Well, we had something like this before. It was called the Cold War. And we are going to see decoupling. It's not a question of if we decouple or not. The question really is how much do we decouple? How much do we decouple on trade? How much do we decouple on technology? I'm not advocating these. I'm simply saying this is happening right now.
And yet within the White House, we're hearing mixed messages and disagreement. President Trump is keen to get this trade deal really finalized with China. And at the end of March, he called President Xi Jinping and tweeted much respect for his handling of the virus. Here's Secretary of State Mike Pompeo today discussing the origins of the virus.
We don't have certainty, and there is significant evidence that this came from the laboratory. Those statements can both be true. I've made them both. Administration officials have made them. They're all true.
Yeah, Pompeo there referring to the laboratory in Wuhan. No evidence on whether that virus came out of a lab there. How does China hope to emerge from this crisis?
China's not going to emerge well. And that's because China went through its own period in the first couple months after the outbreak of the coronavirus, where it was silencing doctors, where it was, again, the elements of political control that we've seen the Communist Party build up over the past several decades were really brought to bear in dealing with this. And while we're looking at governance failures here in the United States, it's important to remember that we had roughly a month and a half or 2 months of governance failures in China. China then pivoted very quickly from getting the situation under control domestically to what I would call a global victory lap in a way that really engendered some frustration and even outright anger by a lot of countries who were in the midst of dealing with this coronavirus, which emerged, as best we know, from China. And we had this in-your-face approach from the Chinese, including what they're now calling their wolf warrior style of diplomacy, of course, coming from a popular nationalist military film in China. But this is not working in China's favor. And what could have been, I think, a relatively straightforward soft power victory by China in taking up the mantle of leadership in the absence of U.S. leadership is actually turned into neither country demonstrating leadership. And I think both countries are going to come out of this quite tarnished in terms of their reputation.
In that context, this week we heard from Deputy National Security Advisor Matthew Pottinger. He delivered a speech to the University of Virginia in Mandarin.
John Pomfret 所描述的美中关系历史中提到。
So a U.S. official speaking out in Mandarin, that in itself is pretty rare. Then Pottinger went on to call on Chinese authorities to recognize diverse opinions, urging, quote, a little more populism, a little less nationalism. How provocative was that in this moment?
I don't think this was a call for regime change by Matt. I think this was an attempt to try to play up the more liberal elements in China's history. The problem is that message is absolutely going to get lost in this whipsaw motion that we just discussed at the senior level. So anything that anyone below Trump does doesn't land as so long as you have a president who is hemming and hawing back and forth on these issues.
Jude Blanchett is the author of China's New Red Guards. He's a China scholar at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thank you very much, Jude. Good to have you with us today.
Thank you.
Scientists from the U.S. to China and everywhere in between are joining forces in ways we've never seen to track the coronavirus and come up with vaccines and treatments. But the pandemic has put other types of scientific research on pause. Reporter Ari Daniel of our WGBH partner program NOVA spoke with scientists eager to get out into the field.
Come June 1st, Philippa Samara was supposed to be on a small boat off the coast of southern Iceland with a crew of five observing and recording wild killer whales like these.
Our study has been going for 12 years now. It is the longest running research project on the killer whales here in Iceland. And that really informs a lot of the conservation measures we think of doing for this population.
Samara is a marine biologist at the University of Iceland, where doing fieldwork is rough even in a normal year.
We are already quite limited in the amount of times we can observe the animals because of the bad weather we get here. It's really a harsh environment.
And now the coronavirus has upended things further for Samara and her small team.
We are possibly not going to have a field season at all, and if we do have it, it will be significantly reduced.
This interruption in data collection is a challenge to any field campaign, but it affects people differently.
Students, they are the most impacted, especially for whom this field season was going to be their first real data collection.
Take graduate student Anna Seldman, whose research on the interactions between killer whales and pilot whales was to kick off this summer. But because of travel restrictions, the project's been scrapped.
What makes me most anxious is that I won't be able to do much this summer, and that means that I will be very much behind.
The university will likely grant her an extension, and she just got word of a scholarship she won. For now, though, she has to sit tight.
This is something that's so outside of my control. The only thing I can do is to just make the best of it.
Elsewhere, as the coronavirus raced around the globe, some field projects were already underway and couldn't be halted. For example, near the North Pole in the Arctic Ocean, about 100 miles from Greenland, an icebreaker called the Polarstern is locked in the sea ice. This year-long expedition, called Mosaic, is studying how the Arctic is reacting to a changing climate and impacting the rest of the world. A couple hundred international researchers from dozens of disciplines are aboard. At the end of each leg of the expedition, field teams swap out. There was supposed to be a handoff in late March.
But that, of course, didn't happen because of coronavirus. I was supposed to be on the ship at the moment.
Rushitsa Dadic, a glaciologist at the Victoria University of Wellington in New Zealand, was told to stay home. Not because she had the virus, but to keep the crew already aboard contained and safe. Her counterpart was to be at sea for 3 months. Now it looks like she'll be there closer to five. This overlap in expertise has proven essential to keeping the research going.
This is not just my own project. This is our project. So the science is still going to be done. It's just not going to be done by me. Hopefully it's a minimum impact.
There will be some impact, All personnel and supply transfers were to have occurred without interfering with research aboard the Polarstern. But due to travel restrictions on other vessels, the ship must leave the ice now, interrupting certain data collection efforts for a month. Researchers are feeling the impact of the pandemic inside their laboratories, too. Sadi Kushbin is a molecular biologist and research director at CNRS, the French National Center for Scientific Research, near Grenoble. He studies cancer, among other things, and he estimates his institute had to kill hundreds of lab mice since many of the animal caretakers aren't allowed to report to work. It's meant the suspension of numerous research projects.
All limitation is frustrating. I think this is a tough decision to know which projects we need to actually keep as a priority. So we have to change our plans.
Meanwhile, in the remote Pampas of Argentina, the Pierre Auger Observatory, a vast facility that collects cosmic rays to study violent phenomena millions of light years away, is slowly winking off. Ingo Alacota is a physicist and project manager at the observatory.
Our staff cannot go out to the field to do the maintenance of the detectors as required. If the situation goes on like this, what we lose is precious data.
But it's not all bad. Alacota says an international conference that was to have taken place in Australia went virtual with great success. A graduate student at the University of Leeds in England told me something similar about an international biochemistry meeting. Now that it's completely online and there are no travel costs, more people are attending than ever before. And there have been some science success stories, even in the midst of all the delays and interruptions. A year and a half ago, the European Space Agency and the Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency launched the BepiColombo spacecraft, which will arrive at Mercury in 2025. This past Good Friday, just a few weeks ago, it flew past Earth for a gravity assist.
Every one of these flybys is extremely important because if you get it wrong, you can either slingshot out the spacecraft into oblivion or you can actually break it so that it crashes onto Earth. So it was a real nail biter.
Gunther Hasinger is director of science at the European Space Agency. He says most of the staff members responsible for the flyby were able to do their jobs remotely, but a crucial quorum was required to be on site in Darmstadt, Germany, working at a safe distance from one another to get the trajectory just right. The BepiColombo even snapped a selfie with Earth in the background.
Looking at that from down here in our COVID situation, in all this mess, and gave a sense of unity.
You mean that we're, as a planet, facing this crisis as one together?
Yes, we are one planet, one human race, and we are in this together.
Under normal circumstances, in a packed control room, there would have been applause, embraces, and champagne. But this past Good Friday, the celebration was remote and sedate, as a beacon of human ingenuity sailed by above our heads. For The World, I'm Ari Daniel.
When the Navajo Nation and Hopi Reservation launched a GoFundMe campaign this spring, the appeal was clear.
Although we are experiencing per capita the same rates of positive cases of COVID-19 as New York City, we are not receiving the adequate resources to protect our communities.
Donors from Ireland in particular answered the call. There's a backstory here. Solidarity between the Irish and Native Americans dates back nearly 175 years, when the Choctaw Nation donated the modern equivalent of thousands of dollars during the Irish potato famine. Historian Turtle Bunbury told The World last year that Native Americans saw their own story in how the Irish were treated.
A lot of other Irish were neglected, very badly treated, pushed to the barren lands in the west of Ireland, dispossessed of their own ancestral lands. It's a very similar story in that regard.
So far, donors have raised more than $2.5 million for the Navajo and Hopi, with hundreds of thousands of dollars coming from the Irish. Returning the favor to our brothers and sisters across the pond, one wrote, "Thank you for helping my ancestors during the famine." A Canadian cabin fever dilemma: sell or downsell the great outdoors? That's coming up later on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Several months into this pandemic, it is natural to ask, which countries are getting it right? Often mentioned on that list are South Korea, New Zealand, Taiwan, and Iceland. But there's another country with a larger population than all of those places combined, and it's reporting zero deaths. That country is Vietnam. The world's Patrick Nguyen is asking, why isn't it getting more credit?
From the start, Vietnam has taken the coronavirus very seriously. This is a public service announcement put out by the government. A message flashing on screen says, the pandemic is threatening the human race. We have entered a war. It's pretty intense.
The government has framed the pandemic as an enemy.
That's Ba Lin Tran. He's a policy analyst in Ho Chi Minh City. Tran says Vietnam rolled out these battle metaphors early on. The deputy premier says everyone needs to take up the fight.
He publicly stated that everyone was a soldier. This is the exact wording from him.
If there's any country that can win a war despite terrifying odds, it's Vietnam. Just ask the French, the Japanese, America, and China. And now Vietnam is reporting zero COVID-19 deaths and fewer than 300 cases in a country with 95 million people. How are they pulling this off? I asked Tran, has the government's call to action really been that effective?
It's not entirely attributable to the government's call. We took the call and we took all the lockdown policies seriously. But then again, we also have this sense for the collective good.
Vietnam and the U.S. reported their first cases the same week in late January. But while President Trump said it was no big deal, Vietnam's leaders went into action with quarantines, making people wear masks, and testing loads of people. So yes, Tran says, Vietnam was on point from the start.
It has been a quick government response thing, but it has also been a cultural thing.
You may recall this song. It went viral worldwide a few months ago. Basically saying, in Vietnamese, the coronavirus can kill you, but in a really catchy way. The song is one of many ways that Vietnamese people have kept up this we're all in it together vibe. Tran says they didn't need some official to tell them this is scary. People remember SARS. They get it.
Instead of going out and protest about the right to go to barbershops and the right not to wear masks, I have no idea, you know, why these people would do that. I mean, it is risky to themselves.
Tran says he's baffled by some of the scenes coming out of America right now, like this one from the Michigan Capitol building. Now, going to a protest with guns and screaming at police would not happen in Vietnam. It is an authoritarian country. Dissent is not tolerated. Which brings up a valid question. The zero death toll figure. Is it actually true? Well, Tran, he's just an independent analyst. And he says,
Only the very top officials in the government know that.
But so far, there's no evidence of hospitals or morgues being overwhelmed. WHO officials say the numbers look real, and a CDC official named John MacArthur said this in a recent conference call.
The communication I've had from my team in Vietnam is that they're working quite closely with the government of Vietnam. They believe that the Vietnamese government are doing a good job.
Doing a good job is one thing, but if there really are zero deaths, Vietnam may be the COVID-fighting champion of the world. The country is now reopening schools, reopening shops, and Tran says Ho Chi Minh City is starting to come back to life.
Today, waking up, it feels like the whole city woke up again. Okay, I can hear noises in front of my house again.
For the world, Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok.
There are growing concerns that immigrant detention centers in the U.S. are becoming COVID-19 hotspots, and that when people are deported from these facilities, they fuel outbreaks in the countries they're sent back to. The world's immigration editor, Monica Campbell, has been tracking this and has the latest.
There are about 30,000 immigrants detained by ICE in the United States. We've had about 1,200 people tested of that population for the virus, and nearly half have those people have tested positive. So that's a very high rate of testing positive. And the concern is that that's a severe undercount and that these detention centers are becoming real hotspots for the virus because of the overcrowding situation that people find themselves in these facilities.
So what happens if you test positive in an immigrant detention center? What's the protocol?
Well, we're not sure what happens to everybody, but I've been following a couple of immigrants detained in Louisiana, particularly the case of one man. His name is Stefan Etienne. He is 26 years old. He faces deportation to Haiti. His temperature started reaching 103, and he tested positive for COVID-19. He was put in a solitary confinement cell. These are prison-like settings. They use the same terminology that they do in prisons. They call these cells the hole. It's not a place where anybody wants to be, much less if you have a temperature. And I talked to Stefan's wife, Melissa Furtado, about her conversations with her husband while he was in this solitary confinement cell. And while I talked to her, she was holding their 3-month-old child.
Oh, he hated it in there. He said there was, like, no cleaning supplies, that there was, you know, there was no fresh air. He hated it in there. His food was cold. He felt like it was the worst, like, that they were trying to punish him for having the COVID.
Solitary confinement sounds like one of the worst places to be if you're sick. Assuming people recover from COVID-19, Monica, from within a detention center, what happens next?
After being in that solitary cell for about 2 weeks, Stefan is now quarantined in a larger room with 12 other detained immigrants who have tested positive. And next, what will happen to him and those others who've tested positive? It's a question mark. Will they remain in the United States until they recover, or will they recover and then be placed on a plane and be deported? He's actually scheduled to be deported next week, which he doesn't believe, nor does his wife believe, will happen so long as he's tested positive. But as time goes by, then maybe ICE will try to put him on a flight to Haiti.
Monica, how has ICE responded to the number of deported immigrants testing positive after they've been sent back to their home countries?
ICE hasn't said anything beyond taking temperature checks of people that they are deporting or putting on those flights or sending back across the border. That is woefully inadequate, according to a lot of medical professionals that I've talked to. When I've pressed ICE on this, they have not given specifics. Rather, they point to the protocol that they've been sticking to for a few months now. And it's unclear whether they're going to step up any sort of checks or revisions or tighten those protocols.
The World's Immigration Editor, Monica Campbell, thank you very much, as always.
You're welcome.
News headlines are a minute away. You're with The World. She identified the first coronavirus long after her death. Finally, some recognition.
I don't think she would be going around claiming credit. She would just say, well, that was a piece of work I did.
And the natural life of cities we hear during lockdown. Bet you can't guess this one. It's not a truck. We'll tell you what it is later on The World. The new coronavirus is pushing millions of people across the globe into starvation, including many here in the U.S. New numbers today show that nearly 1 in 5 children in America is not getting enough to eat. Among the most vulnerable groups are recent refugees and undocumented immigrants. As The World's Rupa Shenoy reports, activists are scrambling to help.
In Queens, New York, under the elevated train tracks, the line for food stretches farther than you can see. Through a bullhorn, Walter Sinche directs people to tables stacked with prepackaged food. He's the founder of the nonprofit community organization Alianza Ecuadoriana Internacional.
Mantengamos la distancia.
Sinche is originally from Ecuador. In March, he got sick with COVID-19, like thousands of others in Queens, as it became an epicenter of the disease. Sinche blames overcrowding because the rent is so high.
And that's how this virus has spread so quick.
and there's hundreds of people that die in our community because of this.
Sinche recovered in time to help deal with a sudden crisis. Food supply lines had been disrupted, and people in his community had lost jobs. Families were going hungry, and food banks were running low. In early April, Sinche got an email from a woman in Manhattan asking how she could help. Vivian Sorensen is a producer for the Food Network TV show Chopped, so she knows a lot of chefs. When Sinche told her hungry people needed food fast, Sorensen knew who could help.
And as they started reaching out to me, I started putting them in touch with chefs and with World Central Kitchen.
World Central Kitchen is a nonprofit that gets food to starving people in many parts of the world. With their help, Sinche's organization now feeds more than 1,000 people a day. He has volunteers regularly disinfect the distribution area, sidewalks and all. Many who come get food are undocumented and are still working.
The delivery guy, the construction worker who's still building or maintaining the city, they're also essential workers, and they're not getting any benefit.
Even though they pay taxes, they're not getting any financial assistance, and they don't have health care if they get sick. Their families are struggling, and the food Sinche helps provide eases the strain.
And that's what motivates me and gives me a life, pretty much.
On the opposite side of the country, Rowan Pish says something similar.
It's pretty kind of scary, you know. It's stressful, but at the end of the day, you know, I feel grateful, thankful, you know, like I did something good.
Pish is a Khmer refugee who fled genocide in Cambodia as a child. He was nearly deported by the Trump administration last year because of a 20-year-old felony. After activism by the Center for Empowering Refugees and Immigrants, or CERI, in Oakland, California, officials expunged Pish's record, allowing him to stay in the country. Now Pish grocery shops and helps deliver supplies to Khmer refugee elders and some of their children and grandchildren. That amounts to about 1,000 people.
They supported me a lot through thick and thin, like to the rallies, support letters. It's time for me to show, like, they care for me, they've been there for me, now it's my turn to show, like, we got each other back, you know?
There's a lot of logistics that we're talking about.
Kate Wadsworth works with Pish at CERI. They got funding to keep their operation going, and the job allows Pish to help support his 5 kids.
It's been hard for him. You know, he's like, oh my gosh, this person didn't answer the phone. And, you know, what kind of chicken do they want? And this person's mad because they said I didn't deliver it, but I did deliver it.
Okay, you can come forward now.
Thank you.
Sure. What is your name?
In Dallas, Texas, the best solution the International Rescue Committee found to feed 60 refugee families was a stand at a busy intersection near where they live.
Here you go. Baby food, wipes, formula, all in there, okay?
IRC coordinator Isabella Chamberlain wears a mask and gloves as she hands out food and supplies. She says the newest refugees from Sudan, Afghanistan, and Myanmar are among those who need the most help.
That population is really struggling. And it's often because their first jobs are hourly workers and their hours immediately get cut or they get laid off and they don't qualify for unemployment benefits right now because they haven't been here long enough.
People drop off donations and Chamberlain goes to farms and greenhouses to pick up produce. She and other volunteers disinfect every item before sorting the supplies into bags. She says setting up the whole system so quickly was daunting.
But it's all about action right now. I think the time to really sort through our feelings will probably come later because there's just people in need and there's no time to be overwhelmed.
If she and others across the country hadn't acted fast, Chamberlain says, people would have starved. And if they don't keep it up, people might still go hungry. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
The science of the pandemic is moving fast. If you have questions about the search for a COVID-19 vaccine or potential treatments, join us tomorrow at noon Eastern for a Facebook Live with Dr. Barry Bloom, a research professor at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. You can email your questions now to myworld@theworld.org. And tomorrow, stream the discussion live at theworld.org. These are hard times for Iran. The country is still reeling from the American airstrike that brought down its most powerful military commander, General Qasem Soleimani. U.S. sanctions have tightened, the economic crisis is worsening, and civil unrest is rising. add the coronavirus pandemic to that equation, it's all limited Tehran's ability to support its proxy fighters in Hezbollah and other militias in Syria. Nesan Rafati is a senior Iran analyst at the International Crisis Group in Washington. Israeli media reported this week, Nesan, that Iran has been evacuating military bases in Syria near the border with Israel since the start of the pandemic. What does it tell us? Is it a singular event or part of a wider strategic shift in the region?
Well, Marco, over the past couple of weeks, we've definitely seen an uptick in Israeli suspected, at least, military operations around Syria. And as you say, you know, the start of 2020 has not been particularly good for Iran, whether it's the coronavirus or the continuing kind of pressure of sanctions. But when it comes to these reports of a Iranian withdrawal from Syria, I'd be a little bit cautious into looking at it as a trend line just yet.
Do you think Iran's withdrawal from those posts in Syria is a direct result of the Israeli strikes?
Again, if we are taking the Iranian withdrawal as a taken, there would presumably be a number of factors. I mean, one thing is that the war has also evolved in Syria. Assad is arguably in a more stable position. So in some respects, Iran's presence in parts of Syria may be less critical as it was. Mm. On the other hand, you could look at it as a result of a combination of coercive factors that make staying in Syria less appealing. So on the one hand, you have these Israeli strikes that have been picking up in pace over the last few weeks. And on the other hand, you have the economic impact of U.S. sanctions, as well as the coronavirus, that in some ways might incentivize Iran to carry out various provocations to show that even under this series of clouds that are affecting it right now, it will also maintain an element of offensive capabilities and won't kind of retrench into its shell.
It's been 4 months since General Qasem Soleimani's assassination. Have you noticed any difference in how his replacement is conducting business?
Well, again, I think if you look at Iraq in particular, we've seen a string of attacks carried out by Iraqi paramilitaries. And that has kind of been Iran's modus operandi over the past few years, including under Soleimani, which is having this network of local allies, proxy groups, whether it's Hezbollah in Lebanon, whether it's these various paramilitary organizations in Iraq, whether it's the Houthis in Yemen. All of these are groups that Iran has some sort of communication with, and maybe not necessarily full control over, but that has generally been how Iran prefers to conduct its conflict strategy. If you look at Iraq over the past few weeks, there's been a series of rocket attacks against military bases hosting U.S. forces that Washington believes is orchestrated by Tehran. We've seen the Iranians launch a military satellite in April. And in that sense, whether you look in Yemen or Iraq or in Syria, at least so far, I think we've seen, again, a bit more continuity than a major shift in how Iran conducts its regional policy.
It is hard to imagine the U.S. maximum pressure campaign on Iran ramping up any further, I mean, through a pandemic. What is left in the U.S. maximum pressure policy bag on Iran that we might see used in the next few months?
Well, so there's what the U.S. Immediately is able to do, which is continue to roll out new sanctions. So at least as far as the economic aspect of sanctions, that basically continues on a very regular basis. But I think the next stage in how the U.S. will try to increase maximum pressure is going to the U.N. And there's an arms embargo against Iran that's going to be lifted in October. That's under the terms of the 2015 nuclear deal. And I think that the administration will first try to make a move to try to extend that. And if that fails, then it may try to attempt to collapse the deal completely by referring to a snapback provision in the Security Council resolution that endorsed the deal to basically say Iran's not compliant and the deal needs to be folded up completely, including the arms embargo.
Nesan Rafati, senior Iran analyst at the International Crisis Group in Washington. Thank you very much.
Pleasure, Marco. Thanks for having me.
Canada knows what cabin fever is all about. It was starting to set in, as it does, at the end of winter, but that's just about the time the coronavirus got there and added another 6 weeks to staring at the walls. Now with the weather warming up, Canadians are getting seriously antsy. Like many places, though, officials have closed access to many public lands and open spaces because of the pandemic, and they're struggling to send a clear message about whether it's safe to go outside. Anita Elash reports from Toronto.
A walk in Toronto's sprawling High Park is the best part of Adrian Salaberry's day. Today, he's here with his 20-year-old son, Facundo.
We're trying to find nobody there, you know, a quiet space. Like, we can do some running and, you know, some exercise.
High Park is the biggest green space in Toronto. It has an oak forest, a zoo, and groves of Japanese cherry trees. During the lockdown, the Salaberries have been heading there to escape their apartment a few blocks away.
Yeah, quarantine is crazy. Yeah. You have to go outside. I mean, you can't stay like so long inside.
We need that. That's the only thing we do in the whole day. But it's healthy, you know.
But this is their last visit for at least a couple of weeks. City health officials are closing the park for the cherry blossom season, which is just starting in Toronto. The Salaberries will have to get their exercise on city streets.
No, it's not the same. You have a lot of beautiful tree here and nature, you know, like you, fresh air, you know, it's so different, totally different, yeah.
High Park is just the latest outdoor space to close since Canada declared a state of emergency and asked people to stay home because of the pandemic. Toronto's Mayor John Tory said he had no other choice.
We know that maintaining physical distancing is simply not possible with the size of crowds that come through High Park every year to see the blossoms.
Hiking trails, campgrounds, national parks. Many of them are off limits too. But 6 weeks indoors is taking its toll, especially on mental health. And officials are struggling to come up with policies that allow for physical activity while maintaining physical distance. British Columbia's top doctor, Bonnie Henry, told people on Canada's West Coast, the risk of catching coronavirus outdoors is infinitesimally small.
So please go outside. Go outside with your family.
In Ontario, the chief health officer, David Williams, was more circumspect.
In general, outdoor means it depends what you're doing and what setting you're in.
Angela Rasmussen, a virologist at Columbia University, says it's hard to know what the risks are.
We don't really have a lot of conclusive data about transmission outdoors. And there are so many variables that can affect that. The wind, the sunlight, the rain, the general weather conditions, the temperature and the humidity. Those can all have a pretty big impact on how long virus can persist in the environment.
What researchers do know is that the virus spreads through respiratory droplets produced when someone coughs, talks, or just breathes.
If you are in close proximity with a number of people, then your risk would increase if one of those people is infected because you would be exposed to more of their respiratory droplets.
That's true even outdoors. But Rasmussen says there's no solid evidence an infectious dose of coronavirus can travel any further than 2 meters. Even if it could,
you would still have to be standing in a position where you would be exposed to enough of those respiratory droplets landing on your nasal mucosa or being inhaled that you would actually get a dose sufficient to start an infection.
There's no proof that's ever happened either. So Rasmussen says parks and outdoor spaces should be safe. That is, as long as everyone follows the rules for physical distancing. In Toronto, city officials are standing their ground, though. Anyone caught entering High Park during this cherry blossom season could be fined $500. For those who can't go without having a peek during high season, there's a webcam live streaming the spectacle on YouTube. For The World, Anita Elash, Toronto.
Here's a name you probably do not know, June Almeida. She was a virologist from Scotland who identified the first coronavirus back in 1964. Almeida and her colleagues named it after the Latin word for crown because that's what it looked like. Her work has gone largely uncelebrated until now, 13 years after her death, with the novel coronavirus in the spotlight. Hugh Pennington is an emeritus professor at the University of Aberdeen in Scotland. He used to work with June Almeida at St. Thomas's Hospital Medical School in London.
Oh, I knew her very well. We were good friends. June spent most of her time at the electron microscope down in the medical school basement in the dark, as it were. And she guarded her little kind of empire very, quite jealously. I was working on quite different things upstairs, but we published a paper together on models of viruses and how you could simulate them using x-rays. So, you know, I knew June very well, and I regard her as one of my most important scientific mentors. She was really a very interesting person to collaborate with and somebody who gave me an enormous start in my career.
So she was working at St. Thomas's Hospital Medical School in London when she was asked to help with this virus they were calling B814. What was that sample and what did she do with it?
She was really very good at having a network of people that she collaborated with, like David Tyrrell from the Common Cold Research Unit in Salisbury, who was trying to isolate common colds, identify them, and he had this virus. And he said, well, June's the obvious person to see what it is. So that's where her breakthrough occurred. When she saw the virus, and she said, aha, here is a new group of viruses identified by the spikes with the knobs on that we're all very familiar with now. Of course, thereafter, coronaviruses didn't seem to be terribly important. They didn't cause serious illnesses. So they remained as curiosities for years until SARS came along, and now, of course, COVID-19. She had a hand in giving the virus the name coronavirus, and she would have been amused that her name is now common currency everywhere. I don't think she would be going around claiming credit. She would just say, well, that was a piece of work I did. You know, how nice.
So as the world is currently seized by this pandemic, what occurs to you about the kind of legacy June Almeida leaves behind? I mean, why did she remain obscure for so long?
I don't know, because she'd done some really good work on other viruses. I suppose she didn't seek publicity. She didn't need to. She had the links that she developed with other scientists. So people came to see her, bringing her material to look at. What June was doing was in really important work, but it wasn't the sort of work that gets on the news in the evening on television or anything like that. She was just discovering things. I have a scar on my arm, which is one of my June Almeida legacies, because she and I agreed that it would be worth trying to grow human wart virus, which was a virus she was interested in. And so she persuaded me to have a bit of my skin taken off of my arm to try and grow the human wart virus in a rather similar way to the way that the coronavirus had been grown. Unfortunately, we were not successful. But I have this badge of honor, which, you know, I can sort of see June Almeida every morning. but she was good at persuading people to do things. She persuaded me to have a hole cut in my arm. So, you know, I suppose that tells the story really, really quite nicely, what June was like.
Hugh Pennington is an emeritus professor of bacteriology at the University of Aberdeen in Scotland and a former colleague of June Almeida, who named the coronavirus back in the 1960s. Thank you very much. Good to speak with you.
Thank you very much.
With cars mostly gone from the streets and businesses closed, everything is a little quieter these days, like this intersection. That quiet street? It's Times Square in New York City. Artist Stuart Foulkes has been collecting the sounds of lockdown from all over the globe. He runs a project called Cities in Memory. He joins us from Oxford, England. Stuart, your project started actually long before lockdown. You've been collecting sounds from all over the world for years. What has been the biggest change since lockdown started?
For us, it's been, I think, being able to use a network of people around the world to collect these sounds, because normally the recordist is the one that's out there kind of tramping boots on the ground and getting the recordings themselves. For me, it's been really exciting to wake up every morning, check my emails and see that, you know, maybe I've got a sound coming in from India or Australia or Argentina, and all of these people are kind of connecting, not just through the sounds, but also through the kind of the stories that are behind those sounds, which we're also asking people to tell us.
Yeah, one thing that comes through in a lot of the sounds you've collected are the sounds of nature, and sometimes in places you would not expect nature to be, like in the city of Thessaloniki in Greece. You can hear owl calls. I know some people might think that sounds like a truck backing up very slowly. That's a Scops owl, to be precise. What did you think that was, Stuart, when you first heard it?
Like you, I thought it was a house alarm or something like that, but there are loads of sounds coming through like that. So there's another great one from London, for example, which is the sound of bees in the cherry blossom, kind of on a main street in London. And normally, you know, bees, the drone of bees operates at a similar frequency level to the frequency level of cars or engines. So you would never be able to hear it normally. But because there's no traffic, all of a sudden you can hear swarms of bees wherever they happen to be in urban spaces too.
That's incredible. Since people are spending more time alone, are you starting to form mental snapshots of like little small intimate moments in people's homes?
There's a lovely recording called Stories for Socially Distanced Children, which is a lady reading out chapters of The Big Friendly Giant by Roald Dahl in Flemish. So she's been recording chapters of children's books and emailing them over to her godchildren and to her relatives, so she can kind of entertain the kids and still be part of the family, even though she can't see them at the moment. And I think that kind of thing is going on all over the world, whether it's, you know, Zoom calls or Skype calls, or whether it's, you know, people sending recordings of stories and things like that. People are finding really innovative ways of keeping in touch with their families, and that's nice to hear.
We actually have the sound of that woman reading The Big Friendly Giant. Let's hear that.
De GVR. De reus tilde de bevende Sophie met één hand op, droeg haar de grot door en zette haar op de tafel.
And what about you? What have you been hearing around your own neighborhood that you didn't notice before?
So I heard some great stuff just last night, actually, as we're allowed out once a day here in the UK for one form of exercise. And I live quite close to the city centre in Oxford. So I headed up to Oxford to where the famous Bodleian Library is. It's part of Oxford University. And normally that's quite next to a main road, and it's usually full of people. It was deathly silent last night. And you can hear this kind of drone coming out the side of this famous old building. And what you realize it is the air conditioning that's being used to keep all of these ancient leather-bound tomes kind of safe and intact, these hundreds of years old books. The air conditioning actually pumps out the smell of old books.
Wow.
So if you close your eyes, it's almost like you're inside the library, because this vent is blowing the smell of old books all over you. It's an amazing experience.
Stuart Folks is a sound artist who runs the Cities in Memory online sound archive. Great to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
The World and all of our planetary sounds come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.